In our last episode, we dove into such conspiracies as the JFK assassination, the Denver airport, and Jack the Ripper. I'm Leah.
I'm Phil.
And I'm Steve. Join us today as we continue our deep dive into conspiracy theories. This is Season 5, Episode 6, Conspiracy Part 2.
If you have an appetite for the strange and bizarre, then pull up a chair and grab a spoon for another intriguing serving of Remnant Stew. Remnant Stew is gluten-free, organic, made from all natural free-range ingredients and guaranteed to provide the recommended daily serving of curiosity.
Well, as we said last time, conspiracy theories are around us everywhere you look. Even when you aren't looking for them, they seem to find me. Whether you're a believer, a doubter, or somewhere in between, you're definitely acquainted with conspiracy theories. We talked a good deal about the Kennedy assassination in 1963 right. And the resulting investigation, which seems to have kind of fueled the modern era of conspiracy theories. Once again, we're going to refer to Oxford English Dictionary for a definition. The phrase conspiracy theory is defined as an explanation for an event or situation that asserts the existence of a conspiracy by powerful and sinister groups when other explanations are more probable. While the phrase conspiracy theory was first in print in 1909, the concept has been around for centuries.
Yes.
We've also quoted a researcher named Gabriel Andrade, who stated that conspiracy theories find fertile ground among people who have a distrust of government or authority figures or other forces that are perceived to be beyond their control. Once again, we're going to stay away from the current political scene.
Way away. We're not going to touch that.
But we do wish to reiterate that conspiracy theories are common tools of political candidates on both the left and the right. And media do love picking up on these theories and running with them because they attract viewers and clicks. So we'd like to encourage our listeners to use caution and reason before you accept assertions as truth. A good dose of skepticism might keep you from being caught up in something that you would later regret. Well, in April 1945, Berlin was a chaotic place, to say the least. The Soviet army had surrounded the city, which was being defended by a few thousand fanatical Nazis. On April 20th, several of Hitler's most loyal staff braved their way into the Führer bunker to celebrate Adolf's 56th birthday.
Not 86, but you're just aging him right now.
Yeah. Well, he looked 86 by that time, but it was his 56th birthday. But the following week saw the disintegration of the government framework that had been in place for the past 12 years. By April 29th, the Soviets were engaged in a block-by-block fighting that had approached within a half a mile of the bunker. On that same day, April 29th, Hitler received word that his Italian buddy Mussolini had been captured by a mob in Milan. He and his mistress were killed, and their bodies were hung up in Milan Square by a jeering crowd. Hitler did not want to suffer a similar fate. According to the 20 or so people who were still in the bunker with him, Hitler gave strict orders concerning what was going to occur on the following day. That evening, he officially married his longtime girlfriend, Eva Braun. The following morning, April 30th, Hitler and Eva enjoyed a late breakfast. Then Hitler held a final briefing with his advisors. The situation in Berlin had grown dire. Hitler issued permission for those who remained in the bunker to attempt to escape through the Soviet lines as best as they could. They were wanting to actually get to the American lines because they thought they'd be treated better by the Americans. Around 2:30 p.m., he and Eva made their way around to all who remained in the bunker and said their goodbyes. Then they disappeared into his private study. Within an hour, everyone who was still in the bunker heard a single gunshot. Otto Gunst, Hitler's personal adjutant, Heinz Link, Hitler's valet, and Trudy Jung, Hitler's secretary, among others, entered the private study where they found the bodies of both Hitler and Eva Braun. Hitler appeared to have suffered a single gunshot wound to the right temple of his forehead. He may have also bitten a cyanide capsule at the same time. Eva Braun was stretched on the couch and had evidently bitten a cyanide capsule. Per Hitler's written and verbal instructions given earlier that day, their bodies were to be carried outside the bunker, doused with gasoline, and set ablaze. Their dogs were also killed and were to be buried alongside them.
Okay, that's so sad. Ugh. That's so sad. Don't hurt the pups.
In fact, well, he actually had the Hitler's German Shepherd Blondie. He had her take the cyanide capsule first, and he watched her die because he wanted to make sure that it would work.
Oh, wow.
The situation outside the bunker was dangerous. The Soviets were getting closer every minute. Working as quickly as possible, the aides dug a trench outside the bunker. Then the two bodies were carried out and set ablaze. What happened next, though, is uncertain. On May 2nd, Soviet troops made their way to the bunker complex. All the German personnel were already gone except for one man who was responsible for maintaining the lights and the electric pumps, which kept water out of the bunker. It was buried down deep below ground, and Berlin has kind of a high water table. They were always continually having to keep pumps running to keep water from flooding this bunker. Soviet troops bungled their way through the bunker complex and did not secure the scene. 2 days later, on May 4th, the Soviets discovered what looked like a freshly dug and covered over trench in the courtyard of the nearby Reich Chancellery complex. Upon digging up the trench, they discovered the badly burned and severely disfigured bodies of a male and female adult. They also discovered the bodies of two dogs. The Soviets kept quiet at first about this discovery of the two bodies. They were shipped back to a mobile forensics unit in eastern Germany to undergo examination. Back in Moscow, Joseph Stalin was breathing hot on the investigators to learn whether or not the Führer had managed to escape. Soon, Soviet investigators came across both Hitler and Eva Braun's dental records. Dental implants and bridge work found in the mouth of the two bodies did, in fact, match the photographs from their dental files. Broken cyanide capsules were also found in their mouths. Though unofficially, the coroners still had some doubts, there was enough evidence for them to inform Stalin that the bodies were, in fact, Hitler and Braun. The Soviets kept quiet about the discovery of the two bodies for more than two decades. It was not until 1968 that they shared with the Western world that they had indeed discovered the bodies of Hitler and Braun. Or did they?
And just let me hold, let's just hold it right there. You're talking about distrust of the government. The right. Soviets were secretive just to be secretive. Like, oh. They definitely held on to any information they had.
Right.
And so I could see where people would go, well, did they?
Right. Well, there's a really great series on YouTube that's produced by a fellow named Mark Felton. He's a historian, and he has very high quality history pieces on his YouTube channel. I highly recommend you check out Mark Felton, and most of them are centered around World War II. Well, according to Mark Felton, there are some major problems with the Soviet coroner's report. For one thing, both corpses are about 8 inches shorter than Hitler and Braun. Now, this discrepancy was written off due to shrinkage due to being burned. But there's another problem, that there was no gunshot wound in the head of the male. In fact, the female had severe shrapnel wounds to her chest, which penetrated her heart. The male was also missing one foot, which appeared to have been surgically amputated. Moreover, even though broken cyanide capsules were found in their mouths, no traces of cyanide was found in their internal organs or in their brains.
Hmm.
After the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, researchers from the University of Connecticut were allowed to examine tissue samples from the two corpses. It's believed that the corpses were actually burned up by the Soviets somewhere along the way. But they determined that while the female was approximately the correct age for Eva Braun, that the male was at least 20 years too young to be Hitler. Based on all of this evidence, Felton has proposed that the corpses were not Hitler and Braun, but were made to look as though they were. And obviously, this raises a lot of questions.
Yes.
The valet.
Right. Now, there have always been a lot of rumors that Hitler had somehow escaped to South America, like some of the other Nazis did. Felton cast doubt on this idea. He says Hitler was not in great health in the last weeks of his life. In fact, he even had difficulty even climbing the steps leading out of the bunker. And even if he had managed to get away somehow, he would have done so completely alone, as all of his staff were still in the bunker until the morning of May 2nd. Instead, Felton surmises that the actual bodies of Hitler and Braun had been carried out into the pit, where they were indeed doused with gasoline and set afire. However, after a couple of hours, it was determined by his loyal staff and that had remained in the bunker that the fire was not hot enough to cremate the bodies
right.
the way Hitler had hoped. Being fearful that the bodies would be discovered by the Soviets and dishonored, Felton surmises that his aides secretly buried their bodies in an unknown location. Before burial, their dental implants were removed. It would not have been difficult to find two corpses that were similar in size to Hitler and Braun, as the nearby Reich Chancellery was being used as a makeshift hospital and morgue. At least 100 bodies were stacked in the basement of this building. As you know, a lot of fighting was going on in Berlin. Right. A lot of people were dying. Once suitable corpses were located, the dental implants were inserted into their mouths along with the cyanide capsules. These bodies were then doused with gasoline and burned in the ditch for the Soviets to, quote, discover. Now, Felton's theory is supported by a 1955 filmed interview with Heinz Ling, which was Hitler's valet. You got it right there, Phil. Ling stated that the Soviets never found Hitler and Braun. He claimed that he and Martin Bormann buried the bodies in a common grave, but he refused to say where.
And there's even more conspiracies that because those possibly were not the right bodies, right, that Hitler didn't die, that he, you know, yeah, right, it's crazy.
Martin Bormann has never been found, never was found dead or alive after he was one of the closest aides to Hitler. And, you know, so there's speculation about him. There were several that did manage to get to South America, and some of them were caught there in later years and brought back, but others managed to live out their lives in secret and not get caught. So interesting stuff about finding the Führer.
And it just, I mean, not having anything to do with conspiracy theories, but it just calls to mind about Saddam Hussein. Like, we saw that on video. Yeah. And I think that's interesting how different all that was.
Right.
Okay, so we're reaching way back for this one. Mm. Elizabeth I was the Queen of England for 45 years from 1558 to 1603.
Well, this is an old theory then.
This is an old one. So this just goes to show that conspiracy theories have been around forever. According to a website called deepenglish.com, Elizabeth was highly intelligent and fluent in six languages. Hmm. In spite of many proposals for matrimony, Elizabeth never married. She became known as the Virgin Queen. But here, there's a conspiracy theory that says Queen Elizabeth was actually a man. Now listen to the story, because listen. Oh, wow. Quoting from the website, many people would dismiss such a theory as sexist twaddle, which is such an English word, right? Twaddle. But the theory has one very notable proponent, the man who brought us Dracula, the writer Bram Stoker.
Yeah, Bram Stoker. He believed this, right?
Yes. Okay. So one day in the 1890s, Stoker was visiting the English village of Bisley. Mm-hmm. He discovered that they maintained an unusual tradition. We should have covered this in Strange Celebrations.
Yeah, right. Oh, wow.
Every May Day, the village dressed up a boy in Elizabethan clothing. When he inquired about the nature of this odd festivity, he was told an astonishing story. According to the villagers, Elizabeth was sent to Bisley in 1543 when she was just a child, so she would escape the plague, which was sweeping London at the time.
A
few months after her arrival, her father, Henry VIII, yes, that Henry VIII.
Oh, that nice guy, huh?
Was planning to visit her.
Yeah.
day before his arrival, disaster struck. Elizabeth suddenly became ill and died. Her governess, not wanting to lose her head, began casting about for a suitable double for Elizabeth. She could find no girls, but did locate a local boy who bore a remarkable resemblance to Elizabeth.
Okay, I can see that.
I can see that happening.
Because, you know, he would not have been, too bad she died yesterday. Why'd you let her die?
Yeah, that's right.
Off with your head, too.
Yep.
So according to the townspeople, Elizabeth was buried in an unmarked grave, and the boy was dressed in her clothes. And when the king arrived, everyone was astonished when the trick actually worked.
Yeah.
But you got to note that Henry was not exactly a doting father and didn't notice that this wasn't her. It had been a few months since he had seen her last. The success of this ruse condemned the boy to live a lie for the rest of his life.
He goes there. He sees this boy dressed up as his daughter and doesn't realize it's not his daughter.
Yeah, doesn't realize it's not his daughter. Then
he probably wasn't paying attention to his kids all that much.
Well, I don't think a king really did pay attention to his kids at all. But then she also was living away from him.
Right.
How do you keep that away from all of the servant staff?
Yeah. Somebody's going to know, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, keep them all silent. Yeah. Really?
That's
true. But who's going to approach the king and say, maybe that's not true? I don't know.
Yeah, like, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. The story was revived in the late 1800s when, during construction work, the body of a girl in Elizabethan dress was discovered in a stone coffin.
Oh, so they actually did find one. Huh?
Stoke was convinced that the body was that of Elizabeth I and that the later Queen Elizabeth was actually a man.
Hmm.
Elizabeth did have an unusually strong character for her time. She ruled firmly but fairly. In her rousing speech to her troops in 1588, she declared, quote, I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king. In an age where women were expected to marry and bear children, she did neither.
Hmm.
Her preference of large wigs and heavy makeup have continued to fuel speculation that she was covering up the fact that she was indeed
a
man.
She's a dude.
Well, she did wear really, really heavy makeup, that's for sure.
So was Elizabeth I actually a man, or is this just an attempt to subject her gender to gender stereotypes? She is buried in Westminster Abbey, so it would not be inconceivable to dig her up and do an analysis.
Yeah, could be done.
But British officials are a little not going for that.
You're not going to dig up in the Abbey, I don't think, no.
And let people examine one of the most famous royals. However, but that girl in the stone coffin, like, let's get some DNA from her.
That might be interesting to look.
This information came from deepenglish.com and also Mental Floss.
Hey, you. Yes, you there listening to this podcast. Have we told you lately just how much we appreciate you? Well, we do. So much. And so can we ask for a favor?
It's an easy favor. If you would, please take just a couple of minutes to give us a review on whatever app you're listening on. It may not seem like a lot, but it really does make a difference.
Yeah, it's all about algorithms, altruisms, Pythagorean theorems, all that techie stuff, which boils down to the fact that it helps other listeners and sponsors find us. So if you enjoy Remnant Stew, it would mean a lot if you took the time to give us a review. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Right.
Now let's talk about first ladies and the influence they have on the presidency.
Okay.
Being married to the president puts a first lady in a unique position.
Yeah, for sure.
Many presidents have confided that their wives are their most trusted confidant. And I'm immediately thinking of Nancy Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
But a little over 100 years ago, there was a rumor that one particular first lady was actually running the country. Woodrow Wilson was elected president in 1912. His first wife, Ellen, who he married in 1885, died suddenly of Bright's disease on August 6th, 1914. And I never looked up what Bright's disease was. Hmm. I wonder what that was. Anyway, Wilson was so distraught by her loss that he told an aide that he hoped to be assassinated. So he was just beside himself. In the weeks after his wife's death, Wilson asked his cousin Helen to move into the White House to keep him, to help him host official functions and to be a companion for him. Well, one day in the spring of 1915, Helen invited a friend named Edith Gate to join her in the White House for tea. Edith had been married to a much older man who was a prominent jeweler in Washington, D.C., but she had been widowed for a couple of years at this point. During the tea visit, Edith had a chance meeting with the president. According to Edith, quote, I came to the White House, turned a corner, and met my fate. Wilson was taken with her and immediately began courting her. Against the advice of his advisors, Wilson proposed to her and they were married in the White House on December 18th, 1915. So is this the only instance of a marriage of a current president?
No. John Tyler, remember, his first wife died. He was the one that had all those kids.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I do remember. Okay.
And then he also married in the White House that's the one of our episodes. I think
where his grandson.
There's two of his grandsons are still living now.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I do remember that now.
Yeah.
Well, the following year, 1916, was an election year. Wilson's advisors were concerned that the public would turn against him for marrying just a little over a year after his first wife's death.
Yeah, it's a little soon.
It is. But evidently, most Americans didn't mind because Wilson, I'm just changing the name of the president. Sure. Wilson carried 30 states and his opponent only carried 18, so he was popular.
He was popular, yeah. Right?
Later in April 1917, Wilson led the U.S. into World War I. By then, Edith never left his side. They worked together in a private office upstairs. He gave her access to classified documents and secret wartime codes. Wilson also let her screen his mail. He insisted that she sit in on cabinet and policy meetings, after which she would give her opinion concerning what decisions should be made.
Right.
She also let it be known to the president which of his advisors she trusted and which ones she didn't.
Yeah, she had a lot of influence,
that's
for sure.
Wow.
At the end of the war, she accompanied Wilson to Europe and sat in on the negotiations at the Treaty of Versailles. Wilson also sought to establish a new organization, which he called the League of Nations, to help prevent future wars because they did not want to have another world war.
Right.
Upon returning home, Wilson found that there was little support for his League of Nations proposal, so or at least in the United States.
Yeah. Right.
So in October 1919, with Edith by his side, he went on a coast-to-coast rail tour to try to drum up support. One evening, he became very ill, and the decision was made to return to the White House. Within a day, Wilson suffered a massive stroke. Edith found him unconscious on the floor of his bathroom. After this, the president was rarely seen in public again. Rumors began to swirl around Washington that Edith was, in fact, acting as president. Well, what should happen in the case when a president is incapacitated right. is that they should resign and then the vice president takes over.
Right, but that's what ought to happen, yeah.
That's right, that's what's supposed to happen. But Edith would not allow this to occur. Vetting the carefully crafted medical bulletins that were publicly released, she would only permit an acknowledgement that Wilson badly needed rest and would be working from his bedroom suite. When a cabinet member came to discuss an issue with the president, they made it no further than Edith,
right.
She intercepted. If they found or if they had an important document for him to review and sign, Edith made the decision whether to take the paper to Wilson or not. If she didn't think it was worth his time, the issue died right there on the spot.
Oh, wow.
So she did. She had quite a lot of influence.
She was running things, basically.
She had a stranglehold.
Though rumors floated around the Capitol, the public was never made aware that for the last year and a half of Wilson's administration, Edith was acting as president and making virtually all the decisions.
Yeah.
So
she was really in charge of the country.
This information came from a biography.com article on Edith Wilson. And I do want to note that while Wilson's plan for the League of Nations went largely unsupported by the United States at the time, the Second World War
right.
brought to the forefront the absolute need
right.
for an organization to promote international cooperation and to achieve international peace and security. So now we have the United Nations.
Right. The League of Nations was the forerunner.
Yeah, that's right.
of the United Nations. Really interesting stuff. On September 12th, 1962, President John F. Kennedy gave one of his most famous speeches as he addressed students and faculty at Houston's Rice University. Quote, "We choose to go to the moon. We chose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard, because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skill, because that challenge is one that we are willing to accept, one that we are unwilling to postpone, and one in which we intend to win."
Okay, with the accent and everything.
I couldn't find the recording of it in time, so I just had to dub Kennedy myself. Well, this speech was given in the early days of the NASA space program, and its purpose was to intensify the energies. The speech, by the way, the purpose of the speech was to intensify the energies and focus the goal of the nation's efforts to be the first to put a man on the moon.
The great space race.
Right. Right. Of course, this was quite an ambitious goal. The United States was already behind the Soviet Union, who had launched the first rocket into space.
Yep.
And had also sent the first man, Yuri Gagarin, into orbit.
Yes, he did.
Right. Kennedy saw the space program as a very tangible way of measuring American capabilities against those of the Soviets. Okay, I was in school at this time. And they sprung something on us called New Math, which really freaked out our parents, but it was all to help us beat the Soviets, beat the communists. Throughout the 1960s, Americans watched a progression from the Mercury program, which single-man missions, through the Gemini series, which sent two astronauts at a time into space, and then to the Apollo missions, which included three astronauts. And each of these programs was built upon knowledge and experience gained from the previous. All efforts were focused on beating the Russians to the moon. There were setbacks along the way, and most
yes.
notably on January 27, 1967, when three astronauts, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, died in a fire during a pre-flight test in the Apollo 1 rocket while it was still sitting on the launch pad. But I really remember this vaguely. I remember about that incident I was watching TV and they broke in the news to to talk about that. Mm-hmm. But by Christmas Eve, 1968, and I remember this very vividly, Americans watching as Apollo 8 became the first craft to orbit the moon. They were broadcasting live. Commander Frank Borman read from Genesis 1 as the camera caught the Earth rise over the moon's surface. Americans and the rest of the world, people of the world, were watching again the following summer on July 20th, 1969, when Neil Armstrong took that first, that famous first step.
So we did do it in that decade.
In the decade,
we barely
right.
got it in there, but
right.
we did.
Well, we got it in there.
Barely got it in, but got it in that decade, yeah. And by the way, the Soviets, in a last-ditch effort to beat the United States, sent an unmanned craft that was designed to land on the moon, dig up some soil, and fly it back to the Earth. It actually took off about a month before Apollo 11. But a couple of weeks into its flight, the Russians uncharacteristically let it be known that their craft had crash-landed on the moon and was unable to return to Earth. The moon landing was and still is a proud moment for America. In 2019, a CBS News poll found that 45% of Americans still consider the moon landing their biggest source of national pride. But not all Americans are on board. Enter one Bart Sabrell, S-I-B-R-E-L.
Yes.
In 2001, Sabrell produced a documentary titled A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon. And this was one of the first in-depth videos to attempt to discredit the moon landings. And at first glance, the video really looks pretty impressive. But when you watch it closer, well, the steam starts to show. One of the mainstays of Sabrell's videos are photos of and videos of Hollywood movie sets complete with a lunar module sitting on a simulated surface of the moon. Uniformed astronauts are seen mingling with the camera and lighting crews. Sabrell cites this as evidence that the moon landings were faked. What he doesn't explain is that NASA and the television networks did, in fact, set up several lunar surface mock-ups in order to show the viewing audience in advance what would occur during the moon landings. I remember seeing those.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I can even clearly remember an episode of Captain Kangaroo.
Oh, remember him. I loved him.
In this particular time, the good captain himself, he left the treasure house, and he visited one of these mock-ups to demonstrate for kids what was going to happen. He even showed how Neil Armstrong, while at the top of the ladder, would pull a lever, which would open a side panel and activate the television camera, which would beam pictures back to Earth. In addition to his video, Sabrell is in the habit of attempting to corner astronauts who were on moon missions and get them to swear upon a Bible that they actually went to the moon. He caught up with Neil Armstrong one day, but Armstrong simply said, quote, Mr. Sabrell, you don't deserve answers. More famously, Sabrell confronted Armstrong's crewmate, Buzz Aldrin, who became quite upset and punched him in the nose. Now, here is the way Sabrell describes this encounter. Quote, if someone said I did not walk on the moon when I really did, that would be like throwing a feather at me. Why would throwing a feather at me make me so violently angry that I'd punch somebody in the face? But according to several witnesses who saw the incident and spoke to police afterwards, it was not quite so simple.
Uh-huh.
As Aldrin was leaving a Beverly Hills hotel in 2002, Sabrell rushed up to Aldrin, demanded that he swear on a Bible that he'd walked on the moon, and then he called him a coward and a liar and a thief. Then the 72-year-old Aldrin clocked him with a right hook. Concluding that Sabrell had provoked Aldrin, the assault charges against the astronaut were dropped by the district attorney.
And you gotta remember, especially and probably even now, but especially back then, these were test pilots. These were tough men that had gone through military men.
Yes.
And so I could totally see Buzz Aldrin just losing it with him.
You've gone too far.
Yes.
In the back of his mind, you know, he's remembering the three men who died on that.
Yeah. There was so much sacrifice.
Right. Yeah.
And his, I mean, they were all friends.
They all knew. They all trained together. They all knew each other.
As competitive as they were,
and this was in a sense sacred too.
Absolutely.
And so this guy, anyway, I'll talk more about him in a minute.
He stepped in it.
According to an article in Mental Floss, a physicist and a cancer biologist named David Robert Grimes published a mathematical equation that estimates how many people it would take to keep a conspiracy secret and how long it would take before that conspiracy was exposed to the public. According to the Grimes formula, Had the moon landing been faked, it would have required 411,000 people to remain quiet. Now, that's a pretty big crowd.
That's huge.
And someone would have spilled the beans within the first 3 years.
Oh, yeah. Just imagine Facebook at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
It would have been over.
This is just kind of my own ramblings about this. But if someone was intentionally trying to fake the moon landings, they would have done a lot better job of making it look real than the actual landings did. When Apollo 11 landed on the moon, it was positioned in such a way that Armstrong was actually in the shadow of the lunar module as he was coming down the ladder. It kind of gave him a sort of a ghostly appearance as the lighting was really poor. And I remember this very clearly.
I was going to say this, yeah.
That it didn't help that the first 10 seconds or so, the picture was upside down.
It was transmitting, yeah.
Okay, I'm almost 12 years old in my living room, and I actually am turning my head upside down to see if I can make sense out of the picture that's coming live from the moon. It took technicians a bit to turn the picture right side up. And that was Apollo 11. Then Apollo 12 was actually, it was really going to be exciting because Apollo 11 just had a little black and white TV camera. Apollo 12 was going to have a color camera. And it worked really well right at first for about the first 20 minutes. And then one of the astronauts accidentally pointed at the sun, which fried the lens and made it useless.
The end of that.
So for the rest of that mission, we were just listening to them on the moon and, you know, talking about what they were doing because we couldn't actually see it. Then everybody knows about Apollo 13, which didn't get to land on the moon due to an onboard explosion. Four more missions did go to the moon, concluding with Apollo 17 in 1972. But as we said, by that time, President Kennedy's mandate had long been met of getting a man on the moon in the 60s decade. These later missions included a moon rover, which traveled over 3 miles from the lunar module. That would have taken an enormous soundstage to fake. And that doesn't even take into account the golf ball hit by Alan Shepard on Apollo 14. Now, who would take that, you know? So in response to accusations by Sobrel and others that NASA never landed on the moon, the agency replied with just 3 words back in 2001, quote, "Yes, we did." The information came from Mental Floss and Popular Mechanics.
Mm-hmm. And I just have to say that this is a conspiracy theory that I ran into somebody that I know and love,
right,
and I deem to be intelligent, that believes this, that believes that the landing was fake.
Right.
And so in order to, like, I looked into it, you know, I was amazed. I was blown away at the effort this guy went
right
into.
There's been several others that tried to do that.
Well, yeah. And he got his 15 minutes of fame.
And
I believe that's exactly why he did it.
Right.
And a punch to the face.
Right.
And a punch to the face, yeah.
But by Buzz Aldrin, how many people can say that?
Right. You know? See this bruise right here?
And now for something completely off topic and off kilter. Brace yourself for the oddity du jour.
One of my all-time favorite childhood staples is the Crayola crayon.
Amen, yeah, brother.
Good oh, ones. Yeah.
I wouldn't settle for those hard, chalky Rose Art crayons.
Oh, no. Send
no,
them
no
back.
I'm a Crayola man through and through.
Right.
Dude, it's got that whole sharpener
on the back.
You got the 64 box.
The 64 box was awesome.
And that was a status symbol in school.
Oh, yeah.
You had that. You're like, oh, my gosh.
Now, whether you correctly pronounce it crayon or incorrectly as crown, we can all agree that the smell of a freshly opened box of crayons can bring us way back to those elementary school days.
Yes.
So
when you're walking through the store and you're just popping them open, just go,
So settle in for a nostalgia trip as we tell you some interesting facts about the Crayola crayon.
Nice.
Number one.
They come in colors.
They come in colors. That famous smell isn't what you think. So Yale University conducted a study in 1982 that placed crayons among the top 20 most identifiable smells.
Right.
That was the wax in it, maybe.
Hey, smell this.
Yeah. That smell? Beef fat. The stearic.
Beef
Excuse
fat.
My pronunciation. Stearic acid that is used to give the crayons a waxy consistency is a beef tallow derivative and very fragrant.
And but it has changed.
Oh, yeah, it's changed.
Yeah, it's changed because it doesn't smell the same as it did when
getting
I was
their
in
beef
school
fat from a different pasture.
I guess.
Grain fed.
Grass fed.
Maybe it's grass fed now.
Grass fed, yeah.
It's grass fed.
Like Wagyu.
Beef fat. Yeah, Wagyu beef
fat.
It's Wagyu beef fat.
Right.
So, number two, Crayola crayons were originally sold door to door.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Sensing, I want to be a Crayola salesman.
That was a probably pretty easy sale.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to buy some crayons?
Sensing that artists weren't their primary demographic, manufacturers Benny and Smith opted to target children and educators by canvassing and selling their 8-pack of crayons for a nickel.
I wonder what year that was, do you know?
I do not. I do not. But I think it was back in its
early 20s or so, maybe. Of it.
Yeah, somewhere in the early 19th century or 1900s, 20th century.
Yeah, the 1900s. Way back then.
Yeah, way back then. Yeah.
Now, also, number three, each crayon used to be hand rolled.
So wow. Roll your own.
Hey, they rolled with care.
Rolled with care. Yeah. For the first 40 years of its business, Crayola employees hand rolled each individual crayon. This was luckily before the invention of carpal tunnel syndrome.
Did they sign their
like,
paper?
What do you mean hand rolled?
This is rolled by technician Bob.
I imagine like a cigarette, you know, maybe you lick the paper and roll it.
Are you talking about wrapped by hand?
Yeah, no, each individual crayon, the paper around it
that was,
was wrapped.
Okay.
Wrapped. Okay, rolled and wrapped. I got you.
This one,
because that would make the crayon like silly putty. They wrap themselves.
So this one's interesting. The American Gothic artist Grant Wood entered a Crayola-sponsored drawing contest at the age of 14. So
I've never heard of him.
Well, now you know Crayola American must Gothic. Have been around a long time then.
Yeah.
Oh, the American Gothic painting.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The painter
standing with a pitchfork with his daughter.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
That painter entered a Crayola-sponsored drawing contest at 14. He took third place in the contest and admitted that placing in the contest inspired him to pursue his art passion.
That's interesting.
Go Crayola.
And we actually covered that painting because I think the old man in the painting was based on his dentist.
Yeah.
And the old lady was now I don't remember who it was based on now, but the old man was his based on his dentist.
1903, I'm seeing Dr. Meekers pointing out. 1903 is the invention of Crayola crayons. Is that the invention or the first?
It was invented by Benny and Smith,
Benny and Smith.
Actually, invented in 1902, offered for sale in 1903. So that one that understands that era about how you would be doing a lot more of it by hand than automation.
And it's funny because you just think that crayons, you don't think about them being invented. Like they're just always there.
Existing, So the story, number five.
I mean,
five,
even the cavemen were using it in their paintings on the walls.
Number five is the actual inspiration for this list, the story that I came across that made me want to do this list. But number five, a top molder for Crayola admitted that he was colorblind upon retirement. So a molder is somebody, I had to do some digging on this. A molder is someone that would pour wax into the molds. And they can do 2,400 crayons at a time.
Wow.
And so, you know, these people are responsible for taking the wax, which I'm certain is named, you know, into its specific mold. So the man, Emerson Moser, for 35 years working at Crayola, most of that time being a molder, was colorblind. Now, he didn't even know that until he did a doctor's visit prior to his employment as a molder, so I guess part of their process. And he has a very, very slight color blindness, but his quote is, "Trying to spot the difference between a cadet blue and blue-green can make me feel, well, like a shrieking violet."
Wow. Shrieking violet. And
that was a
secret. I see what he did there.
Yeah. It was a secret that he kept until he retired.
Right.
Well, and by the way, guys, I'm colorblind. Slightly.
Yeah.
Just to the left.
So one article in studying this claimed that Crayola asked him to donate his wax-covered work boots for their Hall of Fame. Uh-huh. But I couldn't verify that. But that would be pretty cool. I imagine the multicolored work boots that would come from working at a Crayola factory.
That's as funny. A molder, for sure.
And I just have to say, I just had an eye exam where they tested me for color blindness, and I have none. But it's progressively, you know, the little images where it's pebbles and there's a number in there and everything. The last one, I'm like, what number is supposed to be in there? And they're like, there's no number in there.
Because
I'm thinking, I'm colorblind of some sort, right? Yeah. If I can't see a number in there. And they're like, no, we just throw that in there.
That's just the blank space.
She's like, if you do see something in there, then you need to see a neurologist.
I see psychology in you.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the scent from earlier, number six, Crayola had a line of scented crayons.
And
I do remember.
I think
this.
I remember that.
Well, this was, the early 90s in 1994. Yeah.
My kids were little then.
They offered crayons and scents of licorice, cherry, and coconut.
Right.
This lasted less than a year, though, maybe because kids were eating them.
it kind of encourages.
Well, later in 2006, the company tried to capitalize on the gross out market. Didn't know they had a name for that. And created some nastier scents such as Alien Armpit and Booger Buster.
What was that last one? Booger Buster.
Booger Buster. Oh, okay. Booger Buster.
What is an alien's armpit smell
like? It doesn't sound appetizing. Jim Sweat.
Is it like Jim Sweat with metallic undertone?
Yeah, sure, smells like a nickel in an arm. Yeah.
Alien gymnasiums are pretty nasty smelling, I think.
Yeah. And our last one here, number 7, Oprah actually has her own crayon. She had a film debut in the film called The Color Purple.
Color Purple,
that's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when Crayola founder Edwin Benny of Benny and Smith came on her show later, years later, he brought her a box of purple crayons, aptly named The Color Purple. And they bore her signature as well. So
nice.
Oh, that was interesting.
That's pretty cool.
I relied heavily on information from mentalfloss.com and did some fact checking with Snopes.
Very good. I like that one. There was a lot of excitement in 1927. The Roaring Twenties were still roaring along with a seemingly strong economy. Mm-hmm. Talking motion pictures, or talkies, were the newest thing in entertainment, and a very handsome 25-year-old American named Charles Lindbergh was attempting a daring feat.
Right.
On May 20th, 1927, Lindbergh left New York's Roosevelt Field in a single-engine plane named the Spirit of St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Businessmen from the city had funded his flight.
Right.
33 hours and 30 minutes later, he landed at Le Bourget aerodrome just north of Paris. He had become the first person to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. His nickname was the Lone Eagle. And I just want to take a step back from our story and say that, remind our listeners that we talked about Lindbergh before in our season 2 episode called Mind Games.
Yeah.
We talked about this strange phenomenon called sensed presence or third man syndrome.
Right.
It's when someone who's under a lot of physical and mental stress will experience the presence of another person or entity that acts to comfort and encourage them on
to not give up. Yeah.
And it's been reported by many people, and Lindbergh commented on experiencing it during that transatlantic flight. He was alone for so long.
And he had not slept the night before or 2 days before even,
So it's a super interesting thing that our brain does to help us survive harrowing experiences. Yeah. So go back and listen to Mind Games and check that out.
Right.
So back to Lindbergh and all that's going on in the 1920s. His daring captured the imagination of Americans as well as people from all over the world. He was greeted with a hero's welcome in Paris and was later honored with a ticker tape parade in New York.
Pretty sweet.
And I wonder if any of our kids know what ticker tape is. The shy Midwesterner grew up in Little Falls, Minnesota, became an instant celebrity. Time magazine named him as the very first Man of the Year.
Okay, that's still going on now, the Man of the Year, or Person of the Year, now they call it. Yeah.
A popular dance of the flapper era, the Lindy, was named for him. President Coolidge presented him with the Distinguished Flying Cross and Medal of Honor, the highest U.S. military awards. His achievement spurred significant global interest in commercial aviation and in airmail. In 1923, Lindbergh married Anne Morrow, who was a writer and an aviation enthusiast. Together, Charles and Anne flew around the country conducting exploratory flights and aerial surveys. Anne functioned as his co-pilot and radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
She also became the first woman to receive a glider pilot's license.
Wow.
Now, in June of 1930, the couple gave birth to their first child, Charles Lindbergh Jr., who became known as the Eaglet.
All right.
Then on March 1st, 1932, the 20-month-old toddler was reported as abducted from the second story of the family home.
What?
And we've talked about this before. A handwritten ransom note was found at the scene. The case immediately gained international attention and became known as the crime of the century. The following month, Lindbergh paid out $50,000 ransom that included gold certificates.
But then on May 12th, the toddler's body was found in a grove of trees about 4.5 miles from the Lindbergh's New Jersey home. Mm. His skull had been fractured.
Yeah.
2 years later, in September of 1934, a German immigrant, Bruno Richard Hauptmann, attempted to make a purchase using one of those gold certificates. A search was made of Hauptmann's home, and much of the ransom money was located in his garage. A section of wood found in his attic was said to be an exact match to the ladder used in the kidnapping. Hauptmann was arrested for the kidnapping and murder. At his trial, Hauptmann had claimed that the money did not belong to him, but to a friend named Isidore Fisch, who had owed him money.
Yeah.
He claimed that Fisch left the money with him before he returned to Germany, where he had died the previous March. Nevertheless, Hauptmann was convicted of the kidnapping and murder of Charles Lindbergh Jr. He died in the electric chair in April 1936 after refusing a last-minute offer to reduce his sentence to life in prison without parole in exchange for a confession. Case closed. But is it?
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, various authors have cast doubt on the guilt of Hauptmann. There appear to be many unanswered questions.
Yeah. This gets really strange. I mean, this is really a strange theory.
Yeah. Well, and like I said,
it actually is one that's very plausible, I think. Yeah.
Well, an article from cjonline.com, which is the website of Topeka, Kansas Capital Journal, sheds some new and interesting light on the subject. In fact, it details a book by Lisa Perlman called Suspect Number One, The Man Who Got Away. And who does Perlman believe that this man is? Well, none other than Charles Lindbergh himself.
Oh.
Say it ain't so.
Perlman is no novice when it comes to legal matters. She's a longtime attorney and was once the presiding judge of the California State Bar. She plunged into a deep dive about Charles Lindbergh and came up with some interesting information.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lindbergh had befriended a noted French surgeon and biologist named Alexis Carrel, whose work on vascular suturing techniques won him the Nobel Prize in 1912. At the time of the Lindbergh kidnapping, Carrel was working on a perfusion pump which would enable living organs to exist outside of the human body during surgery.
Yeah.
Lindbergh offered his technical expertise, which, according to Carrel, had dramatically improved the pump.
I have a friend who's a perfusionist that works during heart-lung bypasses. He's the right one that keeps them. Yeah.
Perlman also found written notes by those close to Lindbergh which indicated that he was not happy with the baby. He referred to it as a weakling.
Oh.
Its head was abnormally too... Can we just say he? His yeah. head was abnormally yeah. too large and his legs too small.
But he actually referred to it as it.
Yeah. Perlman... written there, but I just... I have a hard time with that. Perlman speculates that Anne Lindbergh may have inhaled toxic fumes when she was pregnant during their many airplane trips, and the baby's health and development may have been compromised. Carrel and Lindbergh were both proponents of eugenics.
It gets creepier, doesn't it?
Yeah, the study of how to arrange reproduction to increase the likelihood of desirable inherited characteristics. You might recognize eugenics as part of the Nazi philosophy, which promoted the idea that Northern European people were designed to be the superior race of the world.
Right.
In fact, Lindbergh was a vocal Nazi sympathizer in the 1930s. He was a guest in Hitler's box during the opening ceremonies of the 1936 Olympic Games.
It's really shady. You know, we think of Charles Lindbergh, we don't think about this shadier side of
stuff,
him.
Yeah, he was touted as a hero, and then just that all the rest of it's kind of doesn't make it into the history books.
It's swept under the rug,
So during the Nazi occupation of France, Carrel became the head of the French Foundation for the Study of Human Problems in Vichy, France. Is that how you pronounce Vichy?
Vichy, yeah. That was the part of France that was not under Germans' direct control, right, but their indirect control,
Well, part of eugenics was the idea that weak infants were meant to die. It was noted that Lindbergh never shed a tear at his son's loss. He had never developed an attachment to his son and, according to some, was even nearly hostile towards him. Hmm. Perlman theorizes that Lindbergh decided to assist Carrel, who hoped to improve his knowledge of the way the human body works, by using this perfusion device to conduct experiments on the body of a living person who would have to die as a result of those tests. Thus, in an odd twist of Abraham offering his son Isaac to God, Lindbergh offered his son to science. In his April 1932 annual report, Carrel identified Lindbergh as a key member of the team that had just completed a historic month-long carotid artery experiment. Perlman theorizes that Lindbergh's key contribution to the experiment was the sacrifice of his son. If this is the case, then Charles Lindbergh Jr. would have died on Carroll's operating table in March of 1932, and the kidnapping would be a hoax. Charles and Anne moved to Europe in 1935 to escape the media circus surrounding Hauptmann's trial. They returned in 1939, but were strong proponents of America staying out of the war. That changed after Pearl Harbor, but even after the end of the war, Lindbergh maintained sympathetic ties with Germany. He and Anne had five more children. Some are still alive today.
Yeah.
According to Perlman, Lindbergh also fathered more children to German women in the years after World War II.
Yeah, I think the deal was that so many men had been killed in Germany that the women were willing to...
get pregnant and
get
reproduce.
Pregnant by, and they if they wanted to pick somebody that had nice features, you know, Lindbergh was certainly one of those, and he was sympathetic to their cause.
When someone like Lindbergh reaches hero status, it's very difficult for public sympathies to turn against them. Thus, it would have been inconceivable to most Americans at the time to even consider that Lindbergh would be responsible for his son's death. The German-accented Hauptmann was a much more believable villain.
Oh, yeah. Right after World War I.
Yeah, exactly.
Nevertheless, Perlman raises some very interesting questions. Perhaps the crime of the century was also the conspiracy theory of the century as well.
Yeah.
So this information came from cjonline.com and from Wikipedia.
Right. That's a really interesting take.
It really is.
Certainly, you can see that how that could be plausible.
So we're bringing you conspiracy theories that are bunk.
Yeah.
Conspiracy theories and maybe something weird here.
Yeah. We have been doing Remnant Stew podcasts for several years now, and we love our listeners. And it's our passion to share crazy and bizarre stories with you. Our continuing goal, however, is to increase our listenership and share our stories with an even larger number of people.
That's right, but growing a podcast audience takes a lot of time and energy. That's where you can help us out. Studies have shown that overwhelmingly, word of mouth is the best promotion tool for the growth of a podcast.
That's right.
So we're asking you to please share Remnant Stew with your friends. Pick out a favorite episode and pass it along.
Right.
We would really appreciate it. And thanks so much already for the support that you've given us. We love you guys.
We really do.
Very much so. This information comes from an article by Chris Ballard, who writes for Sports Illustrated and SI.com. Back in the early 1980s, the National Basketball Association was in trouble. Cocaine use among players was widespread. Attendance was dwindling and television viewership was low. One of the contributors to the dwindling attendance and low viewership was that many of the teams in the league were not very good. They're not talented at all. Six of the 23 franchises were in danger of going bankrupt. To make matters worse, the structure of the college draft actually encouraged teams to lose games, or tank, as they say in the NBA, in order to have a chance to draft better players. Here's the way it worked. Okay, the league was divided into two divisions, an East Division and a West Division. So at the end of the season, the worst team in each of those divisions would meet in the commissioner's office and flip a coin for the number one pick of the college players coming out that next year. Our local here in the cut and shoot area, the local professional team, the Houston Rockets, they were experts at playing bad to get good. In 1982-83, the Rockets ripped off a series of stirring losing streaks and then won the coin flip for Ralph Sampson. A season later, Houston set to work again, losing 20 of its last 27 games to win the coin toss and the rights to draft Hakeem Olajuwon, number one in that year's draft. The guy drafted number three that year was some unknown named Michael Jordan. I don't know whatever happened to him. Well, anyway, the following year, the league's new commissioner, David Stern, was determined to do something about the tanking problems. He came up with a new formula in which the teams with the seven worst records would each get an equal opportunity to participate in a lottery for the first pick in the 1985 draft. And what a pick! Standing in at 7 foot tall and 240 pounds, Patrick Ewing led the Georgetown Hoyas to three college Final Four appearances, winning the national championship in 1984. He could score when near the basket, but he also had a beautiful 18-foot jump shot.
Wow.
He excelled at blocking shots and gobbling up rebounds. He was thought to be a once-in-a-generation player and would change the fortunes of any NBA team fortunate enough to draft him. Knowing that this was going to be a marquee event, Stern decided to hold the lottery on live television from the famous Starlight Roof of the 18th floor of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. Representatives of the seven teams were on hand in case they happened to be the lucky winners, and those teams were the San Diego Clippers, the Golden State Warriors, the Seattle Supersonics, the Sacramento Kings, the Atlanta Hawks, and the Indiana Pacers. Not exactly a who's who of basketball greatness at the time, although the Warriors have gone on to do well in more recent times, and the Pacers too. Oh, wait, that's only six teams, though. I left one out. The seventh one was the New York Knickerbockers, also known as the Knicks. And here's where the controversy enters. According to the fans of the previously mentioned six teams, as well as other NBA skeptics, if your league is struggling and you have a superstar player coming out of college draft, where do you want him to go? Sacramento? Nah. Seattle? Uh-uh. Indiana? No way. You want your big star in the biggest market, New York.
Yep.
The lottery telecast was to be during the halftime of an NBA playoff game between the Philadelphia 76ers and the Boston Celtics. The stage was set with a giant glass basketball-shaped drum. Seven large envelopes measuring 1 foot square had been prepared with no markings on the outside. Inside each was a large card with one team's logo on it, so they could open it up and have a nice big picture of the team's logo who got the first pick. At 1:45 p.m., the game went into halftime and the live feed switched to the Waldorf. What unfolded next has since become the Zapruder film of sports, watched over and rewatched on YouTube and dissected by conspiracy theorists over and over again. Quoting from the Sports Illustrated article, quote, "A representative of the accounting firm of Ernst & Whinney begins tossing seven envelopes into the plastic globe one at a time, pausing for the briefest of moments, perhaps to adjust his aim, before dumping in the fourth, which bangs off the interior of the drum and creases the corner. The drum is spun around five times, and then David Stern reaches into the drum, fumbles around for a bit, and grasping and turning the envelopes, then lifting out the lucky one, which just happened to have a creased corner.
Oh.
When the envelope is opened, it contained, voila, the New York Knicks card. The room was filled with New York media, and they erupted in cheers. Within an hour, the ticket office at Madison Square Garden received over 1,000 calls from people interested in season tickets. A Sports Illustrated photographer caught up with Patrick Ewing and handed him a Knicks uniform for a picture that would appear on the cover of the magazine with the words, "Jackpot, the Knicks won Patrick Ewing." But in Indiana, a television station showed freeze frames of the fourth envelope being forced into the drum in such a way that it forced the corner to be bent. Other reports soon surfaced that the Knicks envelope had been kept in a freezer just before the drawing. This would make it feel cold to the touch, and Stern would have easily felt it. It also came out that the accounting firm of Ernst & Whinney not only represented the NBA, they also represented the parent company which owned the New York Knicks.
dun, dun, dun.
So was there a conspiracy to ensure that the biggest star went to the biggest media market? Stern, who was very happy that people were talking about the lottery rather than drug use or teams folding up, laughed off the suggestion. Quote, "If people want to say that the lottery was fixed, fine," he said, "as long as they spell our name right. That means they're interested. That's terrific."
Any publicity is good publicity.
Ewing went on to play for 15 years with the Knicks. He had a great career, taking the Knicks to the NBA Finals twice, but he never won the championship.
Mm.
Can you imagine being that kid with all of the ruckus being about you?
Right.
Well, according to USA.com, a recent social media post garnered a lot of attention when it claimed that the U.S. government once poisoned alcoholic drinks in order to get people to stop drinking it.
Ooh, that sounds like an overreach.
But is there any truth to this? Let's investigate. Now, what do you think? Would the government do that?
Well, they body snatched earlier.
Right. Okay. Good point.
Project Sunshine.
Throughout recorded history, we find evidence of governments and ruling authorities establishing laws which attempted to define and encourage appropriate behavior among the population. Of course, most modern societies benefit from and thrive in an environment of well-defined laws and rules.
Right.
But sometimes a well-intentioned law, which is designed to regulate certain behaviors, can backfire and have unintended consequences.
Yeah.
In the early 1900s, alcohol abuse was a growing concern in the U.S. Temperance movements had been around since the 1800s and were gaining momentum through and immediately after the World War I years. In many cases, the temperance movement was also linked to the women's suffrage movements.
Oh, the Carrie Nation, yeah.
Yeah, the Carrie women Nation. Had just had enough.
Yeah.
They had had enough of all right. of it. These proponents advocated for a total ban on the sale of alcohol as a means of addressing poverty and other social issues.
The men are spending up all their paycheck on booze, yeah.
The 18th Amendment to the Constitution was proposed by Congress on December 18th, 1917, was ratified by the required number of states, and went into effect January 17th, 1920, known as the Prohibition Amendment.
Prohibition Amendment, yeah.
It declared the production, transport, and sale of intoxicating liquors, including beer and wine, to be illegal.
It didn't actually make consuming it illegal, but making it and transporting it.
Yeah, it was legal because they thought that was enough, and then
we could make them stop making it and transporting it. They won't go anywhere.
Yeah,
but it's one thing to make a law and another thing to get people to obey it.
Really?
Almost overnight, speakeasies and bootleg smuggling networks sprung up to meet the still strong demand of the thirsty public. Many people even began concocting their own home brew, which became known as bathtub gin.
Bathtub gin, yeah. My wife's grandfather in West Virginia, he ran a somewhat lucrative still during this time. that is, until he got caught by the reveneers, as the government agents came to be called.
And I'm from Kentucky, so I'm quite certain that some of my family was in the backwoods and the hollows. Well, one of the ingredients in making bathtub gin and other home-brewed concoctions was an industrial product called wood alcohol, which was used in paints and solvents. That sounds delicious.
Ugh, no.
When government officials learned that wood alcohol was being used to make clandestine hooch, they took action. The companies that made industrial alcohol were required by law to add quinine, methyl alcohol, kerosene, and other toxic chemicals to wood alcohol in order to make it poisonous to drink. So, in fact, the government did do it, but this was not a kept secret.
No.
The practice was well publicized in newspapers and on the hot new medium called radio.
Yeah.
The public was strongly encouraged not to partake in any type of alcoholic beverages, as the base ingredient could contain poisons.
Poisons, yeah.
Many newspapers published editorials in favor of the practice. Quote, "Must Uncle Sam guarantee safety first for souses?" unquote, asked Nebraska's Omaha Bee. But many people either didn't listen or didn't care.
Yeah.
Bootleg networks began hiring chemists to detox the tainted alcohol.
Ooh.
They were paid quite well for their efforts, too. Some have dubbed this the chemists' war.
Yeah.
This prompted the government in 1926 to require more toxic chemicals to be added.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Later that year, between Christmas and New Year's, 41 people died in New York's Bellevue Hospital from alcohol poisoning. Mm. Several hundred more were treated for this condition. It is unknown how many of them experienced long-term effects from consuming tainted alcohol. In the following year, 1927, over 700 deaths in New York City were attributed to alcohol poisoning. Civic leaders in New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and other areas began to publicly criticize the government policy. Quote, "Only one possessing the instincts of a wild beast would desire to kill or make blind the man who takes a drink of liquor, even if he purchased it from one violating the prohibition statutes," proclaimed Senator James Reed of Missouri. Support for prohibition began to wane in the late 1920s, partly due to the impact of the government's poisoning policies. As the Great Depression struck, opponents argued that the ban on alcohol denied jobs to the unemployed and much-needed revenue to the government. In 1932, FDR ran on a platform of repealing the 18th Amendment. "What this nation needs is a good drink," shouted Roosevelt on the campaign trail. Soon after his election, Congress adopted a resolution for the 21st Amendment, which would appeal the 18th. And I always found that interesting when we had to memorize the amendments, that the two drinking ages in America had been 18 and 21. And Prohibition was 18, and the repeal of Prohibition was 21. It is unknown how many people died of alcohol poisoning during Prohibition, but estimates run as high as 10,000.
Yeah, that's a lot.
The 18th Amendment is the only amendment to the Constitution that has ever been repealed. This experiment in regulating behavior that the public didn't want regulated was a spectacular failure. Yeah. And thus the statement in the above-mentioned Facebook post is in fact true, although not quite a conspiracy theory.
It was well documented they did this.
But and this was also really the birth of the gangs of organized crime.
Oh yeah, you know? Big time. That's what started them.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
There was one of the things I saw when I was writing this that in the 70s they had also poisoned marijuana somewhere, and in an effort to keep people from smoking marijuana, and they let it be known, oh, they don't smoke marijuana, might be poisoned, you know.
That's crazy. That's just crazy. Well, this information came from USA Today, Slate.com, and Wikipedia.
Maybe in Wayne's World. There's some bad Red Rope licorice. Don't eat the Red Rope licorice.
That's a good one. Phil here reminding you to check out our Facebook and Instagram pages at Remnants 2 Podcast. Drop us an email to staycurious@remnantstew.com just to say hi or to let us know about any topics you would like to hear us cover in an upcoming episode.
Remnant Stew is a part of Rook and Raven Ventures and is created by me, Leah Lamp. Steve Meeker researches and writes each episode that we then host together. Our audio producer is Philip Sinkfeld. The oddity du jour is brought to you by Sam Lamp. Theme music is by Kevin McLeod with voiceover by Morgan Hughes. Special thanks goes out to Judy Meeker.
She helps edit my papers.
and helps research.
Yeah, she does research as well. Yeah.
For a complete list of sources for this episode, please see this episode's transcript. There's a link in the show notes.
Now, before you go, please hit the follow button so you won't miss an episode. Head over to Apple Music and leave us a review. Share Remnant Stew with your friend, your family, and Buzz Aldrin if you run into him, although be careful of that right hook. Until next time, remember to choose to be kind. And always stay curious.